Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. So, you know, one of the great challenges I've always had with this program, from the very first time I emailed Wayne, my producer, and tried to pitch the new show idea, to every time I tell people about it or we try to promote it in any way, is people always look at me the same way when I tell them I'm doing a radio show about the Constitution. And even though they're mostly too polite to say so, I can just see their eyes glaze over and they're thinking, well, why don't you do a radio show about, oh, dog food, or a radio show about clipping one's toenails properly? Those are about the level of interest that they think they're going to have in the Constitution. Of course, until I start mentioning issues like abortion or gun control or gay rights or whatever, and then gradually they kind of get the message. Today, however, I'm going to test you on this. I'm going to push you a little bit, because the particular topic today is not one that sounds particularly sexy. I'm going to talk to you today about a 100-year-old book. And the 100-year-old book is about economics. And I can't see you, but I can sense your eyes glazing over. No, don't let them happen. The book is actually probably, as one of our guests will tell you, the most important history book that you've never heard of, written by a guy you've probably never heard of. His name was Charles Beard. And it's not just an economic history of the United States Constitution. Stay with me. It's not just that. It's the first history book in U.S. history to very seriously question the real motivations, the real behind-the-scenes motivations of some of the most important people in the history of our nation. And just because of that, just because of the incisive critical approach that Charles Beard took, he's considered to be probably the most important historian we've ever produced. But to this day, people are arguing about his conclusions and about the things that he found and what they mean. And I've got two very prominent, very well-respected historians today to tell us about them. You may have heard of a fellow by the name of Gordon Wood. He's among the most prominent historians in the United States. I'll talk to him in just a few minutes. But first, I'm going to speak to another very prominent historian. His name is Woody Holton. Woody's a big listener, big fan of the show. He's taught for a number of years at the University of Richmond. Just lately, he's moved down to the University of South Carolina, and that's where I spoke to him about Charles Beard.
My name is Woody Holton, and I teach at the University of South Carolina in Columbia.
Mm-hmm. Now, recently, you were at the University of Richmond, so I guess you just switched down to the Palmetto State.
I did, and I'm loving it here.
Congratulations. Well, today, of course, we're going to talk about a subject that I know is near and dear to your heart, and that's the 100th anniversary of Charles Beard's remarkably important book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution.
It's the most important history book that no one's ever heard of.
The most important history book no one's ever heard of. Well, why is that true?
Because Beard really changed the way all of us who write American history write it. Up until his time, almost everyone was writing hagiography, as though the founding fathers really were gods descended from heaven to give us law. And Beard went about as 180 degrees opposite of that as you possibly could. His line was that the founding fathers were human beings, and that they had economic interests, just like you and I do, and that they were thinking about those economic interests and actually pushing those economic interests as they wrote the United States Constitution up in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787.
What a couple of concepts. They were human beings, and they were concerned about their own pocketbooks.
Exactly.
Well, that's a heck of an insight. Okay, I wonder what prompted him to do this, or what he found when he looked.
Well, he noticed, as many of us studying the Constitution have, that one thing that a lot of people said at the time the Constitution was written in 1787 and 1788 was that it would be a real benefit to two, what we today would call special interest groups, what James Madison called factions. And those two groups that really benefited from the Constitution were private creditors. So I'm your creditor not only if I lend you money. What's much more common is if I sell you a horse on credit, the same way you and I use credit cards today. Most purchases were on credit. So private creditors really benefited from the Constitution. And the other group that benefited from the Constitution was bondholders. That is, you know, you probably have a savings bond that your Aunt Gertrude gave you. It's sitting in a lockbox somewhere. You're a creditor of the U.S. government. You're a bondholder. Well, Beard noticed that a lot of people at the time the Constitution was written said that private creditors and bondholders really benefited from it. So he asked a question that seems obvious in retrospect, but no one had asked it before. He said, look, here's these 55 guys that went up and wrote the Constitution, and it benefited private creditors, and it benefited bondholders. I wonder if any of these guys who wrote the Constitution were private creditors or bondholders.
And putting it in modern terms, then, these people were very upfront about it. They said, we've got to benefit MasterCard, and we've got to benefit, Wall Street investors.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I mean, that doesn't sound very popular today. Why? I'm just curious, why would they say that? Why would it be true? Why would they care?
Well, it doesn't sound popular today, but at the time, it was considered a matter of justice. That is, that both of those two groups, bondholders and private creditors, felt like they were getting ripped off up until 1787. Everybody knows that independence was declared in 1776. And during those first 10 years, the United States was a much more small d democratic place than it is now. That is, those farmers, people call them, and I'll put it in quotation marks, rednecks, mm-hmm. just average Joes, really had a tremendous amount of power in that first decade between the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and before the Constitution was written in 1787. So you've got ordinary Joes have all this power. And from the perspective of the founding fathers, ordinary farmers had too much power. They abused that power because, of course, the 99% of us are debtors and we're taxpayers. And so we don't have any interest in promoting the interests of private creditors and bondholders. In fact, just the opposite of that. Your average debtor wants legislation that helps him, but it defrauds the typical private creditor.
So is that what these guys did? They got themselves elected to their state legislatures and they just started changing the rules to mess with the creditors?
Yes. Short answer, yes.
How did they do
the perspective? That's the perspective of the founding fathers.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a book on this topic myself, and I became convinced that while the founding fathers were sincere in believing that private creditors and bondholders were really getting ripped off during that decade that led up to the Constitution, I don't actually think they were. But that's maybe a story for another day. If we just focus on the perspective of the founding fathers, absolutely. Two groups were the victims of great injustice, and those were those bondholders and private creditors. And one of the main things the Constitution does is protect those two groups of people. And I think almost any historian who's looked at this would agree that it does do that, that that was one of its main goals. The big question that has raged since Charles Beer's day in 1913 is, did the founding fathers protect private creditors and bondholders because they were private creditors and bondholders, or did the founding fathers protect private creditors and bondholders out of a larger sense of justice?
Okay, now before we get to that, what particular parts of the Constitution, what parts of the text actually protect those creditors and bondholders?
Okay, so here's a game I love to play with my students. I put up all these quotations from both the founding fathers and other people who were strong supporters of the Constitution. And all of these quotes are statements saying, oh, this clause is the best in the Constitution. Several people, including both James Wilson and Benjamin Rush from Pennsylvania, both said, you know what? If the Constitution only consisted of this one clause, that would be sufficient. We could have a one-sentence Constitution, easy for school kids to memorize. There's this one clause that's fantastic and best and all the others. And actually, I gave a talk at Columbia Law School and asked those law students, what clause was everybody talking about when they talked about their favorite clause in the Constitution? And no one ever guesses it, including those law students. The answer is Article 1, Section 10, the Contracts Clause, that prohibits the state legislatures from interfering in the relationship between the debtor and the guy who lent him money or sent him or sold him stuff on credit. That they cannot impair the obligation of contracts. The worst way they'd impair that obligation of contracts during that decade leading up to the Constitution, in the eyes of the Founding Fathers, was by printing paper money. So your listeners, if they look in their pockets, they're not going to find any Minnesota paper money or North Carolina. Actually, some people in the southern states do have Virginia paper money or North Carolina paper money, but that's a
it's no good anymore. So out of all the provisions in the Constitution, the Contracts Clause of Article 1, Section 10 was considered by at least some of the founders to be the single most important. And I have to tell you, that's a clause that many constitutional law classes in many of our law schools never mention at all. And if they do, it's a minor point, sort of in passing, part of a larger discussion, and onward to the next more important stuff.
Absolutely. And I defy anybody to name another clause in the Constitution that drew as much praise as that one. Now, this sort of the general idea of what the Constitution will do, of course, that people usually spoke in general terms. But when the people supporting the Constitution said what was their favorite clause, the most important one, it was almost always, certainly more than any other, the one they pointed to was that one that I agree with you. Very obscure. Who the heck has heard of Article 1, Section 10? But that's the one at the time that got the most praise.
That is absolutely remarkable. And very just it's stunning, really. I mean, it was very important, especially in the 19th century. And occasionally I'll talk about it in my constitutional law class. But out of all the ones that we emphasize today, that's simply not among them. Okay, well, what did Beard conclude? Did he think that this was something simply with the founders or the framers of the Constitution trying to line their own pockets? Or were they doing it for some other reason?
Well, he thought he would test that hypothesis he went down to the Treasury office where there were records of who had owned federal bonds, just that they, you know, they have a record now whether you in fact do have some savings bonds. And so he went to see who owned bonds. And it turned out that, sure enough, a large percent, in fact, the majority of the people who showed up to write the Constitution were holders of federal bonds. And then it was more difficult research to find out who were private creditors, but these were famous people even at the time. And so a lot of their private papers survive and so forth. And he found that a great many of them were private creditors as well. So his answer is yes. This is putting it too crudely, and he always denied wanting to put it this crudely. But if you and I really want to give the short version of Charles Beard's book that he published 100 years ago, it's this: the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution in part to line their own pockets.
Well, but I mean, I'll make the counter argument. Weren't there some framers, I mean, notably people like Hamilton or maybe Madison, that did not have significant bond holdings and were not private creditors?
Yes. And that's been the debate since Beard. Most historians today would say Beard really did us a favor in getting us away from the biographies and textbooks that just praise the Founding Fathers as gods come to earth. And even as we praise Beard for making that important step, we say he was too crude in saying that they were just trying to line their own profits, line their own pockets. Madison, I want to talk about as a special case, because I do think James Madison did have a very important economic stake in the Constitution. And here's the right that James Madison really wanted. As you know, he initially opposed the Bill of Rights, although he ended up being the author of it.
Right.
But the right that James Madison wanted was the right to be sued and lose that lawsuit. Isn't that weird?
I know where you're going with this, but it does sound odd to hear you say it. That is a very odd right to want. Why did he want the right to be sued?
So here's the situation. In that decade between the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and the Constitution in 1787, there is a perception on the part of people like Madison that creditors are being defrauded, ripped off, unable to collect the money that their debtors owe them. And you know that if you're a creditor and you lend money and you can't get it back, you're going to be much less willing to lend money in the future. You know, once burnt, twice learnt. And so Madison could see the situation, and I think most of us agree that there was a grain of truth in this, where creditors were refusing to lend money. And one of the people they were refusing to lend money to was James Madison. Let's remember that in the spring of 1787, when Madison wrote the Constitution, he was 36 years old, and he was still living in his parents' basement. Now, granted, Stuart, it was a pretty nice basement if you've ever been to Montpelier.
Yeah, I've been there a few times. I wouldn't describe it in quite those terms, but I get your point.
And I'm exaggerating when I say basement. Sure, I think he had a wing of the house and he added one. But my point is, he wanted to go get started on his own. He did start his own business in 1786 with his friend. Really, it started back in 1784. He bought land in upstate New York while attending an Indian Congress. His idea of how to get rich was the same one that had made Washington so wealthy, and that was land speculation. Mm-hmm. And he started a land speculation firm with his friend James Monroe, and then he ran into one huge problem, and that's the problem that anybody starting a business at any time runs into, and that is you need capital. Mm-hmm. You need to borrow money to get the business going, and nobody would lend James Madison the money. So he believed that the reason nobody would lend him money, and I think he's probably got a point here, was that they were worried that under the prevailing laws, hey, I could lend money to James Madison, then maybe the Virginia legislature will pass a law like South Carolina did, giving him 4 years in which to pay it back, which is real unfair to the creditor. So nobody would lend Madison money. Madison was a wannabe creditor. I'm sorry, a wannabe debtor.
Right.
He wanted to be able to borrow money, and the only way to do that was to give creditors an ironclad guarantee that if they lent money, they'd be able to get it back.
So basically, Madison wanted a good credit rating, and part of a good credit rating is, basically that's all a credit rating is the confidence of the creditor that he's going to be able to get his money back. And that seems very plausible to me on an individual basis, but that also reminds me of things that Hamilton said and things that, I mean, goes all the way back, for heaven's sake, to John Adams and Ben Franklin, who were trying to get loans during the Revolution. You've got to have credit as a nation. You've got to be able to assure foreign creditors, among others, that it's worth their while to lend you money. And people had lent us money, and many of these bondholders, far from being Wall Street types, were people who had lent money so that we could get through the Revolution. And there was a moral aspect in addition to a very practical aspect of reestablishing the credit of the nation. So I'm sure that had to be a big part of their motivations when they were writing the Constitution.
Yes. And this is one of the ways that the debate has moved since Beard. We couldn't get to this, though, if we hadn't had Beard to get us off of the this notion of the founding fathers as great lawgivers who have come down from the mountain with their tablets. And so we can have this debate. To what extent was it just straight up economic interest? To what extent was it a matter of establishing the credit rating? I'll give you my own variation on this. I do think the founding fathers were sincere in believing we had to establish both the government's credit rating and the society's credit rating, that is the collective credit rating of individual Americans. So I think they were sincere about that. It's certainly true there was a terrible recession right before the Constitution. It was characterized by falling real estate prices, protests over taxes, huge government debts. Does it just sound familiar to you, Stuart?
Yes, it does. And in their case, armed rebellion in the very spring of 1787 up in Massachusetts.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there was a terrible recession. I think the founding fathers saw the Constitution as the only route out of the recession. Now, I just want to say, since it's kind of a pet peeve of mine, that there was a different analysis of this recession. And I think the founding fathers were sincere but wrong.
Oh, really?
And I think the other analysis is correct. You know why there was a recession in, say, 1786 in the United States? That is, the year before the Constitution. Because the 13 state legislatures, you know, the whole phrase that sums up the Revolution is no taxation without representation, right? Mm-hmm. What's the first thing that happened once we got our own representatives in those 13 states. Taxes that on average were three times higher than Americans had ever paid as British colonists.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Professor Woody Holton of the University of South Carolina all about the 100th anniversary of a remarkable book called An Economic Interpretation of the United States Constitution. And I told you it would be interesting, didn't I? I told you it would be interesting. After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Woody. Of course, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll get back to the discussion. So stick around.
If I were a rich man... All day long I biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build.
Once again, Doug Smith from James Madison's Montpelier, the quiz guy, is in our studios with us today. So, Doug, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
Oh, not so good. I've got lots of aches and pains. Let me tell you about them. No, let's go on.
Let's go on.
You got a good question for us?
I sure do.
Tell me.
Okay, here's the question. Do amendments to the U.S. Constitution correct the original text, or are they whole cloth additions to the length of the text?
So, like if there's something in the Constitution we want to change, do we actually go and strike through the old stuff?
Those are your choices. Strike through or add on?
Oh, man.
Strike through or add on?
Think about that today if you've got... Well, I'm not going to talk too much because I don't want to give anything away. Let's ask our contestant. Do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes, we do.
Tremendous. What is your name?
My name is Kelsey Wagner.
And where are you from, Kelsey Wagner?
I'm from Elizabeth, Pennsylvania.
I didn't know there was an Elizabeth in Pennsylvania. Where is that?
It's about 20 minutes outside of Pittsburgh, actually.
Oh, lovely area. North or south or where from Pittsburgh?
A little southeast.
A little southeast. That's not far from Sewickley then, right?
Yes, it's close to Sewickley.
Oh, which is one of the most gorgeous places. It really is. I wish I could have afforded to live there when I was in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
That's a great place. All right. Well, did you hear the quiz question, or you want me to tell you again?
I did hear the quiz question.
Okay. So just for our listeners, that when you add to the Constitution, when you amend the Constitution, do you just tack on the amendment at the end, or do you actually go through and strike through the language and change the existing text? What do you think?
I think you just tack it on at the end.
Well, let's just see if you are correct. Well, before we ask Doug if you're correct, why do you think that? Why, wouldn't it make more sense just to go back through and, you know, change the text so that everybody's on the same page?
Probably not. I feel like it's easier to have a concise list of what's been added since the original writing of the Constitution.
But then you have to go back and see if it changes anything. I'm not going to talk too much now. Let's just go see if you're right.
Okay.
All right, Doug, did the contestant get the correct answer?
Absolutely. Add on, of course.
Add on. You know, I was about to say before we went to the contestant that I was, it's a technological thing to some extent. I mean, you might be inclined because you're used to word processors to think, of course, you just go back and change it. But there was no such technology when they first started amending the Constitution.
That's
and
right.
A strike through would have been... nasty looking.
And well, in fact, the only the theory of strike through is a relatively modern thought,
mm-hmm.
anyway, because you would do that with, of course, a typewriter or today a word processor.
Exactly, you yep. would. But I mean, theoretically, you could have gone back and simply taken a quill pen and ink and stricken through the old clauses. It would have been messy. It would have required, if you wanted a nice clean copy of the Constitution, to reprint the whole thing. And furthermore, you would have lost a lot of the history of the Constitution because right now. We still have, it's still a part of our Constitution that we have something called the Fugitive Slave Clause. It's still part of our Constitution that we have the infamous Three-Fifths Clause. You know, all these things about slavery, all of which been effectively taken out of the Constitution by the 13th, the 14th, the 15th Amendments.
That's right.
But they're still there. And that's important. And in fact, those are things that I actually teach in my class. I mean, they're still there, and that's part of our history right there in the document.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons the document grows in length, because you add that whole section anytime there's an amendment. Now, of course, there's only been 27 amendments.
That's right.
10 of those are the Bill of Rights.
Right.
And two of those are really indicative of this question. What are they?
I don't know.
The 18th and the 21st.
Of course.
What we did was we prohibited the sale and consumption of liquor.
Right.
And then we had to go back and, whoopsie, undo it.
But we didn't actually strike through the
18th. We couldn't strike through it.
That's interesting you should mention that, though, because that's the first time that we've amended the Constitution and then gone back and unamended the amendment.
That's right. And one might say it was the first time that we had, as a people, tried to legislate through the Constitution.
Yeah, one might say that as well. And a very interesting point. You know, this is actually brings up a sort of a pet peeve of mine. I think, in fact, you and I were both asked sometime for a newspaper article, something about Congress. And I said, well, I'm going into too much detail here. The point is Congress reads the Constitution out loud at the beginning of each session, or at least it has done for the last couple of times. And I think the question was, do you think that's a good idea? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you said, oh, we think anytime the Congress pays attention to the Constitution, that's a great idea. And I said basically the same thing, but I added on, I said, but I think it's kind of regrettable that they're cutting out parts of it that they find uncomfortable. Like the Fugitive Slave Clause, like the Three-Fifths Clause. Now, their argument is, well, they're no longer operative. I understand that, but by golly, they're part of the Constitution. They're an important part of it. And so here's my suggestion to you, House of Representatives, next time you convene, read the whole thing. And maybe that will prompt a debate about some of these important historical issues.
I think you're exactly right about that.
Well, tremendous. We're on the same page, quiz guy. Anything else?
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Stuart, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
Well, Kelsey, congratulations. You answered the question correctly.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Tremendous. You're going to get a T-shirt now, and you can wear it proudly, and all the young men will be after you.
Fantastic.
Because they, at least the young men who appreciate smart women.
That's the only type of young men I want talking to.
Well, Kelsey Wagner, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Woody Holton of the University of South Carolina. And before the break, Woody was telling me that one of the first things that the brand new United States did after they had successfully declared their independence from Britain was to raise taxes, and that they raised them so high that they caused an economic depression.
So I think the Founding Fathers were completely sincere in believing that the only way out of that terrible recession that preceded the Constitution was to write the Constitution and give these ironclad guarantees to creditors, both private creditors and to public creditors, that is, people who own government bonds. So I think the Founding Fathers were sincere about that, but I'm persuaded that they were wrong about that. There was an alternative explanation for the recession that preceded the Constitution. And that's the one that somebody like Daniel Shays, who was a leader of that rebellion called Shays Rebellion in Massachusetts in 1786 and 1787. What Daniel Shays would say is, yes, there's a recession, but it's not because the state legislatures are being too nice to us debtors and taxpayers. Daniel Shays would say, we've got a recession because the 13 state legislatures taxed the economy into a recession. You know, the big
and
phrase
were,
from
and
the
were,
American
were the
Revolution
taxes
was,
pretty high?
Taxation with
mm-hmm. And were the taxes pretty high then?
Look, they rebelled against the British over taxes, right? Well, guess what happened as soon as we got our own 13 state legislatures ruling these now independent states? Those legislatures adopted taxes that were on average three times higher than the old colonial taxes.
Oh, good heavens.
And so, yeah, imagine if your taxes tripled. Not only would that hurt you personally, but Congress would tax us into a recession. And so I think this is actually the better explanation for the recession that led to the Constitution. So my own reading is that the Founding Fathers were sincere in believing that the recession was a result of what both Alexander Hamilton and Elbridge Gerry at the Constitutional Convention called an excess of democracy. That is, the Founding Fathers said, you know, we let those darn redneck farmers get into power in the legislatures, and they passed these horrible laws to protect debtors and taxpayers, and that's destroyed the country's credit rating. We got to write a constitution that protects creditors and protects bondholders, and by the way, a much less democratic constitution than any of the 13 state constitutions. That's a point that Beard emphasized. And so I think the Founding Fathers were sincere about that. But I also think they were wrong. I think the reason for the recession was more what Daniel Shays was saying, which was that the 13 state legislatures had taxed the economy into recession.
But Woody, you are the first historian I've ever heard take the part of Daniel Shays, and I must say that just makes you a rabble rouser, doesn't it?
I wear the sobriquet with great glory.
I see. Well, I am struck by a parallel here that's actually about 100 years out of date. But I recall that when the British colonists, many European colonists, came to British North America, many of them said that they were coming for religious freedom. And then one of the first things they did was turn around and establish local theocracies. And
right.
You're telling me basically the same thing happened 100 years later when we have our revolution. They say taxes are too high. We don't like taxes. And then they turn around and raise taxes.
Right. Now, in fairness to them, their big complaint was not that taxes were too high, but taxation without representation. But it
yeah,
is
but you and I you and I both know that the level of taxation was also a big issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And then and so you're absolutely right that it is pretty hypocritical that they then came along and adopted big taxes. And so actually, see, here's where I think the Charles Beard type analysis would be actually more accurate than what Beard himself did. That is, he looked at the economic interests of the men who wrote the Constitution. And I think they had economic interests, but I think they were more complex. Like I've told you about Madison wanting the right to be sued.
Mm-hmm.
But if you apply a Beardian analysis to the state legislators, and you're absolutely right, that they did adopt very high taxes, having complained about high British taxes. Why did they adopt high taxes? Well, where's the money from all those taxes going? It's going to pay off both federal and state bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And guess who owned federal and state bonds in those years between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution? Not the soldiers who had originally received the bonds as payment for fighting for our freedom. The soldiers had been forced, in most cases, to sell their bonds to speculators at mm-hmm. a fraction of their face value. And so...
So it really was all those nasty Wall Street types lurking in the background and causing state legislatures to raise taxes. So they really were at fault.
I would argue that those economic interests were very powerful. I think Beard got it wrong in the sense that he sees them as exerting their biggest power at the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787. I actually think the bondholders and private creditors really exerted their power over the state legislatures in the previous years. And then, of course, once the state legislatures passed all these pro-creditor, pro-bondholder laws, that is high taxes, then you get people like Daniel Shays rebelling and forcing the state legislatures to go to the other extreme. And I'd be the first to admit that the other extreme of, for instance, Rhode Island, which printed up an immense amount of paper money, the other extreme is also bad.
Very, very interesting. The way you're describing Beard, he sounds like an early scientist. He was someone who was questioning and skeptical and wanted evidence-based conclusions. And so you're applauding him for that. But like anybody who's a pioneer in his field, perhaps he didn't take his analysis far enough. Perhaps he didn't dig deeply enough into the evidence. And therefore, building on Beard is to some extent contradicting his conclusions. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I guess I'd just put it the other way around, that the best way to build on him is to use a Beardian analysis on Beard. And I think he himself, he was really just trying to provoke thought. That
right.
People had sort of praised the founding fathers. They brought their hearts but not their heads to history. And that's what Beard changed.
Well, I must say that I do appreciate an economic analysis based on evidence much more than I do mythology and legends about cherry trees. So I join with you in applauding Beard. And has he been pretty influential and pretty important in the last 100 years?
So my dissertation advisor at Duke was a historian named Peter H. Wood. And he once described for us, the group of graduate students, he described the history of American historians in the 20th century as one long effort to get Charles Beard.
Well, then at least he prompted a great deal of reaction and a great deal of interest.
Absolutely.
On his
what
peers.
He really wanted to be provocative, and he succeeded in that.
Very good. Well, before we finish here today, Woody, any final thoughts about Charles Beard and about his magnum opus?
If anybody listening is interested in Beard's magnum opus, they can just type it right into Google and it'll pop right up. It's called An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. And, you know, the Constitution provides for copyright, but there's a limit to it. And his book is out of copyright. I really recommend it to anybody want to read it for free online, they can do so.
Is it readable?
Oh, I think it's a lot. Well, there is one chapter, his biggest chapter, where he goes, calls the roll of the 55 founding fathers and goes through them one by one and talks about their economic interests. That one can be pretty tough. You probably want to skip to your favorite people like Hamilton and Madison and Washington, most of whom, by the way, did not have direct economic interests, as you pointed out. But the rest of that one can be kind of like reading the encyclopedia. But I think he is a great writer, and he knows he's being provocative. He knows he's kind of being edgy. And so I think it's a lot of fun. And I think you'd be most struck by how many quotations he has from the people who wrote the Constitution and then the people who championed it in the state ratifying conventions, how many quotations he has saying this thing is going to benefit creditors. And people not ashamed of that because they really felt that creditors had gotten ripped off in that decade between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Well, so for all of us history buffs and for all of us constitutional law buffs, a really good summer beach read, Charles Beard and an Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Well, Woody Holton of the University of South Carolina, thank you so much for coming on your weekly Constitutional.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And wasn't that a great conversation with Professor Woody Holton of the University of South Carolina? Who ever thought economics and a 100-year-old book could be quite so interesting? Well, after the break, we'll speak to another fellow about Charles Beard and about his remarkable book. That guy's name is Gordon Wood. But first, of course, we'll have a little discussion of what's happening this week at Montpelier. So stick around. Baby, you're a rich man. Baby, you're a rich man. Baby, you're a rich man too. You keep all your money in a big brown bag inside a zoo. Not a thing to do. Baby, you're a rich man. Baby, you're a rich man. Baby, you're a rich man too. Sean O'Brien, what is happening this week at Montpelier?
Stuart, we are in the afterglow of Constitution Day.
The afterglow.
And enjoying the quiet time that happens in late September as we contemplate what happened earlier in September.
It is. You know, that's a great time. It's a great way to explain it. You know, ratification was happening. It was happening out in the States. But Montpelier, things were quiet.
Well, yes, they would have been quiet because James Madison was not back from Philadelphia because they had just finished signing the Constitution in 1787 on September 17th. But now, this is a gorgeous time of year to come to visit.
It is gorgeous weather.
We got fall, the leaves are starting to turn, the weather is crisp.
A little nippy, yep.
And this is, if you've been to Montpelier before, this is the time to come back.
Absolutely.
Because we're getting into just the gorgeous fall weather. Of course, as always, you can get onto the property for free, have a picnic, play a little frisbee, throw a football around with your kids. And then, of course, you want to go into the mansion.
Absolutely.
And see the amazing things.
Sean, do you know what my favorite place on Montpelier's grounds is? Not in that mansion. The mansion, the second floor library, that's my favorite space. That's a holy of holies. But
I'm guessing the formal garden.
No, it's not.
No.
I love the formal garden. Go hang out with the lions. It's great. It's fantastic. But I like the space between the Center for the Constitution and the mansion that is right next to the temple. Because
the Walnut Grove.
It is so gorgeous. It's like a cathedral.
It's pretty amazing. I've been there.
They're tall. Mm-hmm. It's huge. It's a cathedral-like. They look like pillars in a cathedral. And I walked there early on some morning. In fact, one morning I walked there, and it was like a Sunday morning. And it was silent. Except for just occasional bird song.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is a place to contemplate big thoughts.
And the Walnut Grove is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is you can see the mansion.
Yep.
You can see the Center for the Constitution, which is a very important educational space,
yes,
of course.
Yes, it is.
You can see Madison's ice pond.
Yep.
And his ice house underneath the temple.
Yep.
It's also the location where the Madison slaves would throw away the Madison garbage.
I'm sorry, that just kind of sends a dissonant note into this otherwise very nice discussion. So you're telling me I like the trash heap the best?
Not too deep under the soil in that area, our archaeologists have discovered amazing things about the Madison history in what they refer to as Dolly's Midden, what I refer to as the Madison's trash heap.
And strangely enough, trash heaps are archaeological treasure
troves. They're gold for archaeologists because you can find out an amazing amount of stuff about people's lifestyles and their history and what kind of dishes they were using. And it's an amazing space. And we haven't fully explored it yet, but we're looking forward to in the future truly excavating that area.
Okay, you can excavate it, but leave the trees.
The trees will stay.
Thank you.
The Walnut Grove is a beautiful space.
Indeed it is. Sean O'Brien, James Madison from Montpelier, thank you very much.
Enjoying the fall.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject today is a 100-year-old book by a fellow named Beard, and it's all about an economic interpretation of the United States Constitution. But don't touch that dial. It's not the least bit boring. This is one of the most important history books in the history of the United States. Now, before the break, we talked to Professor Woody Holton, a fan of the show, a buddy of mine, and that was a fascinating discussion. We're going to get a different perspective now from one of the most prominent historians in the United States. His name is Gordon S. Wood, and he is the Elva O. Way University Professor and Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. He's won all kinds of awards, including a Pulitzer Prize, a Bancroft Prize, a National Humanities Medal. The list goes on. And he's going to give us his perspective on this extremely important book.
Beard's book was probably, and is probably, the most important and impact-laden book in American history ever written.
It created
a sensation. I don't know of any monograph before or since that had such a powerful effect on American life. And it tore the intellectual community apart. Beard was subverting or undermining the high-mindedness of the founding fathers, suggesting that they had economic motives at heart, and that was what was driving them. I think that really had a creative sensation, to say the least.
It sounds like Beard was one of the first to actually start knocking the founders off of their pedestals.
Well, he wasn't the first. There had been some hints earlier. I think as the progressive era began to emerge, people became upset at the undemocratic character of the Constitution and began to criticize some aspects of it, the division of power, in somewhat the same form as today, that the judiciary has a role that was not a non-elected judiciary, has a role that was undemocratic, and you have an undemocratic Senate. And so a whole host of issues arose, I think, at the turn of the century. And, of course, Beard is part of a larger cultural shift that's taking place in the Western world, as a kind of revolt against formalism. Up to that time, people took things at face value, and you have a group of intellectuals, Marx would be one, Freud would be another, who are suggesting that the reality lies beneath the surface of things. And it got expressed in a kind of cynical view that the real sources of politics are in the back room. What you hear in the legislature, what you hear in the congressional record is not to be counted. What you've got to do is go beneath the surface and find the hidden reality. It's in that atmosphere, that culture that Beard is coming out of. And that's what he did to the Constitution.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned Karl Marx there just a moment ago, and it does seem to me that, Marx was very deterministic about the economics determining politics, determining society. Was Beard that far? I mean, did he feel also that economics was the primary and maybe even the sole determinant of the actions of
the founders? Well, I don't think he was not technically a Marxist, mm-hmm. in that he didn't buy into the whole scenario of what was going to happen in the future. But I think he's affected by Marx, as many people were, that the reality of things lies beneath the surface, and that economic motives are prominent, if not dominant. And I think Beard is affected by that, and he certainly is trying to make a case for that in the case of the framers of the Constitution. What he suggested was, in kind of crudely put, and I think if one reads his book today, you almost wince at the crudity of his argument. His sources, sense of motivation is so crude. What he was, in a sense, saying that these men who were framing the Constitution owned bonds in the federal government that had depreciated radically during the Confederation period, and that if a strong federal government were created, those bonds, which were 10 cents on the dollar or 1 cent on the dollar, would suddenly become at a worth face value, and that people would make a killing. That is roughly what he was saying. I don't think there's much evidence of that today, and in fact, scholarship in the 1960s, We the People by Forrest MacDonald showed that bondholders were on both sides. The anti-federalists, the people who opposed the Constitution, owned as many bonds in the federal government as the so-called framers. But I think in a larger sense, Beard had something going for him. I'm sympathetic to the larger issue, not the proof he has, which I think is crude and unsophisticated and certainly not plausible by today's standards, but the larger issue he raises, I think, is still compelling, that there is a fear of democracy that runs through the elites at the time, and that the Constitution was designed to curb that democracy as it was being expressed in the state legislatures. And Madison, who is often referred to as the father of the Constitution, James Madison, certainly believed that these excesses of democracy, as he called them, the vices of the political system of the United States, as he wrote in an unpublished paper, were the source, in his mind, of his reform efforts to create a new Constitution. And the Virginia Plan, which is the working model for the framers, is his creation. And it is based on what he called the mutability, multiplicity, and the injustice of state laws being passed by rampaging Democratic majorities. And he wanted to find some way of curbing those Democratic majorities. I think that fits, in a larger sense, Beard's conception of the problem. I just don't think he has any persuasive powers with his crude sense of motivation. So I accept the argument in a larger sense. That is certainly an issue of what lies behind the Constitution, the curbing of democracy. And I think that still has validity.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of those state legislatures had gone fairly far in doing things that were designed to benefit debtors and harm creditors. So there was some legitimate concern, I suppose, if one thinks that it is legitimate to make sure that creditors are protected.
Well, I think that's true. Now, the issue is alive and well today. We see this happening in Egypt. We see this happening in the Middle East. Is democracy majority rule? And what Madison was trying to say is, now his minorities that he's concerned about are not minorities that we care much about these days, that is creditors. Mm-hmm. But if you think of it in the larger issue, minorities need to be protected against rampaging Democratic majorities. That's the issue that's raised in the Arab Spring. It's the issue that's right front and center with what happened in Egypt. And Madison was trying to find a way to accommodate majority rule, not to repudiate majority rule, but to somehow find a way of limiting it so to protect minority rights and individual liberties. And I think that issue is alive and well, and I think the Constitution was designed with that issue in mind, and I think Beard had that in mind as well. Although any concern for minority rights. So in his objection to the Constitution is that it's limiting what the majority can do, which was essentially the progressives' complaint against the existing Constitution in 1913.
Really? So Beard actually went so far as to think basically we just shouldn't worry about creditors' rights. We should just let the majorities do what they wish.
Right. I think this is where Beard, I think, was wrongheaded in that he was very sympathetic to the majority and did not concern himself with the minority. But I think the issue, he certainly raised the issue that the Constitution was designed to somehow curb rampaging majorities. So in some sense, he sees it, as many people did, political scientists, Smith was his name, said the same thing, that the Constitution is an undemocratic document. And of course, this coincides with the introduction, with the Senate's being elected directly by the people, constitutional amendments passed right almost simultaneously with Beard's book, and the feeling that the Constitution was preventing people from fulfilling their wishes, that there were too many checks and balances, too much separation of powers. And of course, we have some of this today too. People are very frustrated with the loggerheads that go on in Washington. And I think the issue is not going to die, because there's always tension between majority rule and minority rights.
Well, the minority rights are very inconvenient.
Yes, that's right. If you're in the majority, you want
yeah,
things done.
Exactly. No, and bankers and bondholders don't make sympathetic minorities.
That's the problem, yeah. I think, from our point of view. But if you think of it in abstract terms, and not just the minorities as creditors, but minorities in other sense, then I think Madison's concern for minority rights, and what he called majoritarian factionalism,
right,
I think is quite legitimate. Now, the revolutionaries didn't anticipate this. I mean, John Adams was debating a Tory in 1775, and this Tory said to Adams, watch out for these congresses you're creating, these provincial and continental congresses. They can be tyrannical. And Adams says, well, that's crazy. The people, he says, that's contradictory. The people cannot tyrannize themselves. Democratic despotism, said Adams, is a contradiction in terms. Well, within a decade, many of the elites, including John Adams, came to realize that there can be such a thing as a democratic despotism. And I think that's what happened too with Morsi in Egypt, with people came to realize that the Islamic Party, the Freedom and Justice Party, was acting in a tyrannical manner. That is, it was not looking after the other parts of the society, the minorities that hadn't won the election. And so I think that's where Morsi ran into trouble. I think this is a major problem in the Arab Spring, the ignoring of the people left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you got bombings in Iraq. The Sunnis feel they're a minority now, and the only recourse they have is bombing. Well, fortunately, we haven't come to that.
Well, Shay's Rebellion, I suppose, was a fairly close brush with that idea. But something you said a moment ago is rather surprising, that John Adams would ever question the idea of a tyranny of a majority. And in fact, there's a pragmatic argument out here beyond the theory as well. And the pragmatic argument with regard to with protecting the rights of creditors is that if you don't do that, you're not going to have any credit. And John Adams was actually trying to secure our credit overseas, and he must have seen that we're not going to get any future loans if we don't protect the rights of creditors.
Well, I think he, in 1775, he's debating the logic of the rebellion, and he's up against the Tory who says, watch out. And Adams at this point responds rhetorically, but I think believing that the people could be trusted. Now, within a few years, he's come to know better, and he also, I think, realistically, had a fairly realistic sense of human nature and was very mistrustful right away. And, of course, he is important in acquiring credit for the United States, especially from the Dutch, without which we would have had a hard time. The Dutch and French credit is what helped us get through the revolution.
Did Beard ever acknowledge that purely pragmatic consideration, that if you don't respect creditors' rights, you're not going to have any credit?
No, I think he was just trying to explain in what he would call modern realistic terms what went on. Now, he could have made a better case for himself, I think, if he had had more information or thought about it more. But at the point where he was in 1913, people's sense of motivation, I think, was pretty unsophisticated. And he thought that by showing these people as bondholders, that would be enough. And I just don't think that is enough. I don't think that's the reason. I think they're really more scared of things beyond just the creditors. They're concerned concerned about democracy running amok. And I think that's something that we can appreciate. We've appreciated in our history at other times, and we can see it happening. I think before our eyes, we saw it in the French Revolution.
Yes.
We're seeing it in the Arab Spring as well. So I think there needs to be more. Beard didn't have enough sympathy for the framers, but he had a sense that what they said was not to be trusted, because they never admitted openly that they were doing what they were doing was looking after the minority creditors. Madison wanted a veto power given to the federal government to prevent the veto power over all state legislation, which would have been incredible. I mean, it's so impractical when you think about it. And what happened instead is we got Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which prohibits the states from doing certain things. Number one, printing paper money, which is probably a good thing in our day.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
And from debtor relief legislation, ex post facto laws, and a series of prohibitions,
mm-hmm.
which met Madison's objections. Although Madison was deeply disillusioned and disappointed with the final Constitution, because he thought he lost, losing his veto power or his negative over all state legislation, he thought would destroy the system. He thought that was so essential. Now you might ask, why did Madison think that the federal government was going to be immune to the same forces that were working in the states? And there's where you get into something tricky. He thought that somehow the elevated nature of the government and the smallness of representation, I mean, the first Congress was only 65 members.
Right.
That was smaller than any of the state legislatures, and it's representing 4 million people. You know, Massachusetts had about 360 people in its legislature. But I think Madison thought that a better class of person was going to get into the federal government, and that they would be more enlightened, more like him and more like Jefferson than the kinds of radical, unenlightened, illiberal, parochial mind. These are the terms he uses to describe the people who were in the state legislatures in the 1780s.
Well, I'm not sure whether James Madison was correct that our national legislature was going to be any more enlightened than any of the state legislatures of his time, but he and all the other founders were doing their best to predict the future, and of course that's fraught with peril. At any rate, we had to wind up our interview with Gordon Wood, and so I asked him if there's anything else he wanted to tell us about Charles Beard's remarkably important book and an economic interpretation of the United States Constitution. Any other thoughts on Charles Beard before we
conclude? I think it's important that we do look back at this very historic book. And as I say, I don't think of any book in American history, any history book, was ever more important than his. It shattered the country. I mean, intellectuals divided on it, and it reverberated right through all the way up to today, 100 years. It's still being talked about. I think the book is not much read anymore, but the impact of Beard on American history writing has been profound.
Well, Gordon S. Wood, I certainly appreciate your time, and I thank you very much for being on your weekly Constitutional.
Oh, well, my pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Woody Holton and to Gordon S. Wood for telling us about Charles Beard's important book. Thanks also to our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson, and to our distribution engineers, Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harrison. Before I go, did you notice our new theme music? That comes courtesy of the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Thanks a lot, guys. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.